Chapter 22. If we could build a Russian Republic, to give to the persecuted people of the Tsar's domain the same measure of freedom that we enjoy, let us go ahead and do it. We need not discuss the methods by which that purpose is to be attained. Let us hope that fighting will be postponed or averted for a while, but if it must come, I am most emphatically in sympathy with the movement, now on foot in Russia, to make that country free. I am certain that it will be successful, as it deserves to be. Any such movement should have, and deserves our earnest and unanimous cooperation, and such a petition for funds as has been explained by Mr. Hunter, with its just and powerful meaning, should have the utmost support of each and every one of us. Anybody whose ancestors were in this country, when we were trying to free ourselves from oppression, must sympathize with those who now are trying to do the same thing in Russia. The parallel I have just drawn only goes to show that it makes no difference whether the oppression is bitter or not. Men with red, warm blood in their veins will not endure it, but will seek to cast it off. If we keep our hearts in this matter, Russia will be free. Russian sufferers, on December 18, 1905, an entertainment was given at the casino for the benefit of the Russian sufferers. After the performance, Mr. Kleeman spoke. "Ladies and gentlemen, it seems a sort of cruelty to inflict upon an audience like this our rude English tongue, after we have heard that divine speech flowing in that lucid Gallic tongue. It has always been a marvel to me, that French language. It has always been a puzzle to me. How beautiful that language is. How expressive it seems to be. How full of grace it is. And when it comes from lips like those, how eloquent and how liquid it is. And, oh, I am always deceived. I always think I am going to understand it. Oh, it is such a delight to me, such a delight to me, to meet Madame Bernhardt, and laugh hand to hand, and heart to heart with her. I have seen her play, as we all have, and oh, that is divine. But I have always wanted to know Madame Bernhardt herself, her fiery self. I have wanted to know that beautiful character. Why, she is the youngest person I ever saw, except myself, for I always feel young when I come in the presence of young people. I have a pleasant recollection of an incident so many years ago when Madame Bernhardt came to Hartford, where I lived, and she was going to play, and the tickets were $3, and there were two lovely women, a widow and her daughter, neighbors of ours. Highly cultivated ladies they were. Their tastes were fine and elevated, but they were very poor, and they said, "Well, we must not spend $6 on a pleasure of the mind, a pleasure of the intellect. We must spend it, if it must go at all, to furnish to somebody bread to eat." And so they sorrowed over the fact that they had to give up that great pleasure of seeing Madame Bernhardt, but there were two neighbors equally highly cultivated, and who could not afford bread, and those good-hearted Genises sent that $6, deprived themselves of it, and sent it to those poor smiths to buy bread with. And those smiths took it and bought tickets with it to see Madame Bernhardt. Oh yes, some people have tastes and intelligence also. Now, I was going to make a speech, I supposed I was, but I am not. It is late, late, and so I am going to tell a story, and there is this advantage about a story, anyway, that whatever moral or valuable thing you put into a speech, why, it gets diffused among those involuted sentences, and possibly your audience goes away without finding out what that valuable thing was that you were trying to confer upon it. But, dear me, you put the same jewel into a story, and it becomes the keystone of that story, and you are bound to get it. It flashes, it flames, it is the jewel in the toad's head, you don't overlook that. Now, if I am going to talk on such a subject as, for instance, the lost opportunity, oh, the lost opportunity. Anybody in this house who has reached the turn of life, 60, or 70, or even 50, or along there, when he goes back along his history, there he finds it milestoned all the way with the lost opportunity, and you know how pathetic that is. You younger ones cannot know the full pathos that lies in those words, the lost opportunity. But anybody who is old, who has really lived and felt this life, he knows the pathos of the lost opportunity. Now, I will tell you a story whose moral is that, whose lesson is that, whose lament is that. I was in a village which is a suburb of New Bedford several years ago. Well, New Bedford is a suburb of Fairhaven, or perhaps it is the other way. In any case, it took both of those towns to make a great center of the great whaling industry of the first half of the 19th century, and I was up there at Fairhaven some years ago with a friend of mine. There was a dedication of a great town hall, a public building, and we were there in the afternoon. This great building was filled, like this great theater, with rejoicing villagers, and my friend and I started down the center aisle. He saw a man standing in that aisle, and he said, "Oh, look at that bronzed veteran, at that mahogany-faced man. Now, tell me, do you see anything about that man's face that is emotional? Do you see anything about it that suggests that inside that man anywhere there are fires that can be started? Would you ever imagine that that is a human volcano?" "Why, no," I said, "I would not. He looks like a wooden Indian in front of a cigar store." "Very well," said my friend, "I will show you that there is emotion even in that unpromising place. I will just go to that man, and I will just mention in the most casual way an incident in his life. That man is getting along toward 90 years old. He is past 80. I will mention an incident of 50 or 60 years ago. Now, just watch the effect, and it will be so casual that if you don't watch you won't know when I do say that thing, but you just watch the effect." He went on down there and accosted this antiquity, and made a remark or two. I could not catch up. They were so casual I could not recognize which one it was that touched that bottom, for in an instant, that old man was literally in eruption, and was filling the whole place with profanity of the most exquisite kind. You never heard such accomplished profanity. I never heard it also delivered with such eloquence. I never enjoyed profanity as I enjoyed it then more than if I had been uttering it myself. There is nothing like listening to an artist all his passions passing away in lava, smoke, thunder, lightning, and earthquake. Then this friend said to me, "Now, I will tell you about that. About 60 years ago that man was a young fellow of 23, and had just come home from a 3 years whaling voyage. He came into that village of his, happy and proud because now, instead of being chief mate, he was going to be master of a whale ship, and he was proud and happy about it. Then he found that there had been a kind of a cold frost come upon that town and the whole region round about. For while he had been away the Father Matthew temperance excitement had come upon the whole region. Therefore, everybody had taken the pledge. There wasn't anybody for miles and miles around that had not taken the pledge. So you can see what a solitude it was to this young man, who was fond of his grog. And he was just an outcast, because when they found he would not join Father Matthew's society they ostracized him, and he went about that town 3 weeks, day and night, in utter loneliness, the only human being in the whole place who ever took grog, and he had to take it privately. If you don't know what it is to be ostracized, to be shunned by your fellow man, may you never know it." Then he recognized that there was something more valuable in this life than grog, and that is the fellowship of your fellow man. And at last he gave it up, and at 9 o'clock one night he went down to the Father Matthew Temperance Society, and with a broken heart he said, "Put my name down for membership in this society." And then he went away crying, and at earliest dawn the next morning they came for him, and routed him out, and they said that new ship of his was ready to sail on a 3 years voyage. In a minute he was on board, that ship and gone. And he said, well, he was not out of sight of that town till he began to repent, but he had made up his mind that he would not take a drink, and so that whole voyage of 3 years was a 3 years agony to that man, because he saw all the time the mistake he had made. He felt it all through. he had constant reminders of it, because the crew would pass him with their grog, come out on the deck and take it, and there was the torturous smell of it. He went through the whole 3 years of suffering, and at last coming into port it was snowy, it was cold, he was stamping through the snow 2 feet deep on the deck and longing to get home, and there was his crew torturing him to the last minute with hot grog, but at last he had his reward. He really did get to shore at fast, and jumped and ran and bought a jug, and rushed to the society's office, and said to the secretary, "Take my name off your membership books, and do it right away. I have got a 3 years thirst on." ... And the secretary said, "It is not necessary. You were blackballed." Watterson and Twain as rebels, address at the celebration of Abraham Lincoln's 92d birthday anniversary, Carnegie Hall, February 11, 1901. To raise funds for the Lincoln Memorial University at Cumberland Gap, Tennessee, ladies and gentlemen, the remainder of my duties as presiding chairman here this evening are but two, only two. One of them is easy, and the other difficult. That is to say, I must introduce the orator, and then keep still, and give him a chance. The name of Henry Watterson carries with it its own explanation. It is like an electric light on top of Madison Square Garden. You touch the button and the light flashes up out of the darkness. You mention the name of Henry Watterson, and your minds are at once illuminated with the splendid radiance of his fame and achievements. A journalist, a soldier, an orator, a statesman, a rebel. Yes, he was a rebel, and, better still, now he is a reconstructed rebel. It is a curious circumstance, a circumstance brought about without any collusion or prearrangement, that he and I, both of whom were rebels related by blood to each other, should be brought here together this evening bearing a tribute in our hands, and bowing our heads in reverence to that noble soul who for 3 years we tried to destroy. I don't know as the fact has ever been mentioned before, but it is a fact, nevertheless. Colonel Watterson and I were both rebels, and we are blood relations. I was a second lieutenant in a Confederate company for a while. Oh, I could have stayed on, if I had wanted to. I made myself felt, I left tracks all around the country. I could have stayed on, but it was such weather. I never saw such weather, to be out of doors in all my life. The colonel commanded a regiment, and did his part, I suppose, to destroy the Union. He did not succeed, yet if he had obeyed me, he would have done so. I had a plan, and I fully intended to drive General Grant into the Pacific Ocean if I could get transportation. I told Colonel Watterson about it. I told him what he had to do. What I wanted him to do was to surround the Eastern Army and wait until I came up. But he was insubordinate. He stuck on some quibble of military etiquette about a second lieutenant giving orders to a colonel or something like that. And what was the consequence? The Union was preserved. This is the first time, I believe, that that secret has ever been revealed. No one outside of the family circle, I think, knew it before, but there the facts are. Watterson saved the Union. Yes, he saved the Union. And yet there he sits, and not a step has been taken, or a movement made toward granting him a pension. That is the way things are done. It is a case where some blushing ought to be done. You ought to blush, and I ought to blush, and he, well, he's a little out of practice now. Robert Fulton Fund, address made on the evening of April 19, 1906, Mr. Clemens had been asked to address the association by General Frederick D. Grant, President. He was offered a fee of $1,000, but refused it, saying, "Shall be glad to do it, but I must stipulate that you keep the $1,000, and add it to the memorial fund as my contribution, to erect a monument in New York to the memory of the man who applied steam to navigation." At this meeting Mr. Clemens made this formal announcement from the platform. "His is my last appearance on the paid platform. I shall not retire from the Gradis platform until I am buried, and courtesy will compel me to keep still and not disturb the others. Now, since I must, I shall say goodbye. I see many faces in this audience well known to me. They are all my friends, and I feel that those I don't know are my friends too. I wish to consider that you represent the nation, and that in saying goodbye to you, I am saying goodbye to the nation. In the great name of humanity, let me say this final word. I offer an appeal in behalf of that vast pathetic multitude of fathers, mothers, and helpless little children. They were sheltered and happy 2 days ago. Now they are wandering, forlorn, hopeless, and homeless, the victims of a great disaster. So I beg of you, to open your hearts and open your purses, and remember San Francisco, the smitten city. I wish to deliver a historical address. I've been studying the history of Dasher A. Let me see A. Then he stopped in confusion, and walked over to Jen. Fred D. Grant, who sat at the head of the platform. He leaned over in a whisper, and then returned to the front of the stage and continued.
Oh yes. I've been studying Robert Fulton. I've been studying a biographical sketch of Robert Fulton, the inventor of the inventor of the electric telegraph and the Morse sewing machine. Also, I understand he invented the air derrière saw. I have it at last, the dirigible balloon. Yes, the dirigible, but it is a difficult word, and I don't see why anybody should marry a couple of words like that, when they don't want to be married at all, and are likely to quarrel with each other all the time. I should put that couple of words under the ban of the United States Supreme Court, under its decision of a few days ago, and take 'em out and drown 'em. I used to know Fulton. It used to do me good to see him dashing through Tiletown on a wild broncho. And Fulton was born in Dasher A. Well, it doesn't make much difference where he was born, does it? I remember a man who came to interview me once, to get a sketch of my life. I consulted with a friend, a practical man, before he came, to know how I should treat him. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.